I would not like to dive too much into your vita, and you mentioned Vancouver. Mm-hmm. Just to repeat that you were born there in 1975. That means you're a Canadian citizen. You belong to the Canadian part of American or North American jazz, which has very important participants. But very importantly, you spent 2 years in Boston, not at Berklee School of Music, but at the New England Conservatory. And I would like to start with a quote about that period. I never envisioned I would be the big band guy. I blame that on?
On Bob Brookmeyer.
What did he do? Did he turn you from what to where?
I had no plans to take a master's degree. I had finished my bachelor's degree in Montreal. I was a composer, but a composer of small group music. I was writing for a quintet that I had, and you know, things were starting to happen for me a little bit in Montreal. And I thought, well, here's where I'm going to build my career. And then it all sort of got derailed when I started to correspond with Bob Brookmeyer, who I'm sure you know is an incredibly influential composer and band leader and trombonist, born in 1929. And sort of came up through the ranks and had long associations with Jim Hall and Jerry Mulligan and Thad Jones, Mel Lewis, and his own compositional work, very well represented by the Mel Lewis Band and his own New Art Orchestra. Bob was one of my heroes, and I was teaching a composition and arranging class at McGill University in Montreal. And we were looking at some of Bob's music in class, and so I thought, well, you know, his email is right there on his website. That was unusual because this was back in the prehistory of the internet. This was, you know, 1999. But Bob did have his email address on his website there for everyone to see, so I thought, well, why not write him, and then I can get some answers about his compositions directly from the source. So we started to correspond a little bit, and then at one point he suggested that I send some of my own music to him. I was like, okay. Piled it, you know, in an envelope and, you know, burned a CD. This is all sort of very old school, right? You know, take it to the post office. And then Bob, he took a listen to it and suggested, well, why don't you come and study with me at New England Conservatory in Boston? And I thought, well, that's not an invitation that you turn down. And so I started there in the fall of 2000. There were a few things that were very transformative about that whole time. First was just being able to, of course, connect with Bob, who is someone who has, you know, seen and experienced most of recorded jazz history, and just the depth of the knowledge and the lived experience that he had was incredible. To have access to a mentor like that. But then also there was an ensemble at the school, at NEC, a big band that performed only student compositions, and it rehearsed every week. And so I quickly realized, well, this is a very unusual situation. I will never have access to a big band every week ever again. That's not something that I have now. You know, my band in New York, Secret Society, we cannot rehearse every week. You know, we rehearse for concerts, but it's not, you know, a regular thing. So this was, you know, such a great opportunity to learn the craft. If you can do it, write something and hear it played every week, it's as close to instant gratification as you get writing for a large ensemble, which is normally very far from instant gratification. It's more like you spend three months working on something before you even get a chance to hear a tiny bit of it. And at NEC, I was able to, you know, sketch out something the night before rehearsal and bring it in and hear it right away. And if I didn't like it, I could rip it up and bring in something different the next week. So the combination of those things really created a shift in focus for me because of this opportunity both to write for the big band every week and also to get feedback on what I was writing from one of the great masters of big band writing. You know, so we would play it like Wednesday night and then I record it and go in for my lesson on Thursday and we'd pick it apart with Bob. And he has a reputation of being a very gruff personality. There was he had that quintet with Clark Terry in the 60s, and of course Clark Terry's nickname is Mumbles, the character that he does for sort of old blues singer. You know, those, he's got, you know, the famous Mumbles recording. So the nickname of the quintet was Mumbles and Grumbles. And Bob representing the latter half there. But he was actually very very sweet to me and very encouraging, and encouraged me to think about so many things in music that teachers don't normally focus on. You know, it's easy to get information about how to score a voicing for a big band, and, you know, like orchestration and harmony, all of those things are very easy to, you know, there's many books that will tell you everything you need to know. But with Bob, it was much more about pacing and architecture and transitions and the experience of the listener in real time listening to your piece, and whether you are giving the listener enough time to appreciate and understand and process the sounds that you are giving them. And does your piece sort of teach the listener how to listen to the work as it goes along? And is the architecture of the piece sound, is it communicating over time, structurally, what you want it to communicate? Those are very difficult things to teach and to convey, and because they feel much more mysterious and subjective. But you know, Bob would always encourage us to listen to the music as if some other motherfucker had written it. That approach of like kind of divorce yourself from your music and listen to a recording of it as if you hadn't written it, and sort of imagine what your reaction would be to this music if you were hearing it for the first time. That's, I think, one of the most important things that I got from my lessons with Bob, is that idea of trying to listen to the music with fresh ears, which can be a very difficult thing if you spent 3 or 4 months working on a single big band chart, and then, you know, trying to forget all of that and start afresh is a challenge. But that's something that Bob, it's a challenge that Bob really encouraged us to undertake.
You already mentioned the Secret Society, which is a strange name, actually, for an ensemble that operates in public. But if I understand the literature on you, the interviews you did so far, it's a hint to the fact that big bands today operate almost hidden, as opposed to the heydays of Duke Ellington and Count Basie. And you also mentioned that you don't rehearse like you did in the Boston days. You rehearse before concerts. So a little bit on the conditions about leading a band like Secret Society. How did you get the musicians attracted to your music if they cannot earn much with it?
Well, as far as the name, in the early days, I knew that I didn't want it to be just, you know, the Darcy James Argue Jazz Orchestra or whatever. That seemed a little bit boring. Our early performances were at places like the basement of the punk rock club CBGB, punk rock crucible, or across the street on at the Bowery Poetry Club, and kind of underground type venues like that. And so Secret Society, I think it sort of felt like it was an apt descriptor for this little kind of cabal of big band nerds trying to make a go of it in New York, despite the lack of state cultural support or anything like that. You know, it's very independent. And everyone who is performing in these sort of New York big bands are doing it because of the love of the music, and are willing to make enormous sacrifices of their own time and their practice time, because a lot of this music is very challenging to make it happen. So when I first moved to New York, I was participating in a workshop sponsored by BMI, which is sort of the American version of GAMA, and they have a BMI Jazz Composers Workshop that you would have a chance to have your music read through, not every week, but once a month, which is not bad, and get feedback on it from Jim McNeely and Michael Abeni, who were the workshop directors at the time. through that workshop and through that ensemble, I met other young composers who were sort of kindred spirits, and I met some musicians who were willing to play some rehearsals of big band music for free. So I would call people up, and it would be like, "Hello, you don't know me, but my name is Darcy, and I'm new in town, and I have all of this really, really hard big band music, and I'd like to rehearse it on Tuesday at the Union, and I can't pay you anything. Did I mention that the music is really hard?" People would be like, "That sounds great. I would love to do it. I love playing really hard music." Thankfully, in New York, there is an ecosystem for that, because musicians come to New York because they want to have those experiences, and they understand that, especially when you're young and just starting out. I mean, now I'm able to give people, you know, a little honorarium for their time for rehearsing, but at the time I was really broke and couldn't. And then people understand that, and they are certainly willing to try it, you know, at least once. And then if they decide that the music is too hard or not hard enough or not interesting enough, then maybe they'll be busy next time you call. It was like that for about a year and a half before I finally found the right personnel for the secret society, the right co-conspirators for that little cabal.
We had the chance yesterday to attend a public rehearsal with the CCJO, you rehearsing and performing with for the third time here in Cologne, MERS, not to forget, and the WDR Jazz Orchestra also. I spoke afterwards, I telephoned with a member of the band, I don't tell you who, but he only told me positive things. And one of the sentences I grabbed was, "The band sounds better after rehearsal." To listeners, this should be normal, but he stressed that very often the band doesn't sound better after a rehearsal, and that was something, a very positive point that goes to you. A different question in that regard. You already stressed that it is hard and demanding music. So what do you do if someone who is willing but who is not up to the job, how do you get this person out, or how do you get him improve or her improve her skills to perform your music?
Well, I think it's not a challenge of ostentatious virtuosity. You know, it's not that I've written things that are very fast and technical and difficult to execute from a technique point of view. The challenges are more concentration and a challenge of rhythmic authority. The rhythms that I write are not the usual rhythms that you would encounter in jazz. And they do require everyone in the band to sort of think like a rhythm section player and to really know exactly where in the rhythmic grid everything falls, and to internalize that with a lot of accuracy. And that's something that it is possible for literally anyone, regardless of their level of instrumental experience, to increase their ability to execute rhythms accurately. You know, it's really just a matter of feeling it and understanding it, and you know, often there's a moment you can tell in rehearsal where it clicks and people go, "Oh yeah, no, I get it now. I can subdivide, and if I subdivide it this way, then I can play that rhythm." So it is challenging music, but it is music that I won't say anyone can play, but it is when I go into an ensemble, great musicians like the CCJO, or if I go into a student group that has less highly developed instrumental skills, really most of the time I am still focusing on rhythm and rhythmic accuracy, and just being able to place things and to play them with confidence and to project a kind of rhythmic authority to the rest of the group. You know, if that happens, well, that's really the prerequisite. That's where we start. And then, you know, I won't say the rest of the music takes care of itself, but the most important thing is that we have a foundation in groove, because ultimately, despite all of the, you know, the complexities of harmony or orchestration or voice leading or all of the little details, like it has to groove. That's the ground floor, and then we start from there.
It sounds very friendly, and as if everyone who has applied for the job or has been asked by you for the job has been up to the job. But what do you do if someone doesn't really meet your expectations?
Well, you know, it's being a director is about problem solving, and so it is usually unproductive to lose your temper or to yell at people or to make them feel bad about their musicianship. You know, my job and my whole approach is to try to communicate to people, well, if you're struggling with this part, well, like, let me help you and let's work this out. And sometimes it might be, well, okay, we only have a certain amount of time in rehearsal, but let me at least get you started so that you can take this part home and spend several hours working on it if that's what it needs, but that we at least have a foundation, a point on which to begin, and that you understand with clarity, you know, what you're doing right and what needs to be improved and how to improve that.
That's almost precisely what I heard on the telephone yesterday. Darcy, you work in a field of music, and the prime element in this type of music is improvisation. Jazz is supposed to be the improvisation music number one, and that's what not only jazz publicists say, but also musicians believe. But where comes composition? And I think composition is an increasingly important part of jazz, and although people hear many compositions, somehow it's not valued as such as, like, say, in classical music. But what is the reason that jazz composition is somehow falling onto lower places in the hierarchy of elements? We could also think of the rhythms which are unique to jazz, like swing. Spoke to a music ethnologist who says there's only one music culture in the whole world, in Romania, that also has swing. Why is composition not at the top of it?
There are so many layers to that question. I think there is perhaps a tendency in certain circles. There are musicians and there are critics. Their primary interest in jazz is improvisation, and they are interested in sort of radical difference every time. They are interested in music where there is no predetermined structure to it, and they love the sense of possibility that literally anything could happen. And there are many musicians who operate that way, and there's sort of a community of listeners and critics where that's really what they want. And there's obviously some really great music that comes out of that sort of improv priority, placing improv sort of central to the way that even, you know, large ensembles that play no pre-composed music at all. And that's great, but that's not what I do. And that's not my particular interest. For me, as a listener, I am less interested in how it was made and more interested in what it is. What is the sonic result? So, of course, there's many forms of music that I love that don't involve improvisation at all. For me, as a composer, what is interesting about the possibilities of improv are that it allows me to use the skill set of the musicians that I work with in a way that is, I feel, maximizes the musical possibilities. I could easily write music that was through composed and did not contain any improvisation at all, but there are things that improvisers can do better than I can write. And so when I write, I try to ensure that when I leave space for improvisation, what I'm leaving space for is for that musician to express themselves within the context of the music that I've written in a way that I would not be able to do. A lot of my music ends up being focused on one particular soloist and being almost like a concerto for that soloist. And I'm interested sort of in the interaction of that soloist with the music that I have written and putting them in a context where they would play differently from the way they might ordinarily play. In my group, I have soloists like Ingrid Jensen, for instance, and there are situations, musical situations, that I can put her in where she plays ideas and responds in a way that I've never heard her in any kind of small group setting. And for me, that's sort of what's exciting about this, of looking for opportunities to showcase individual improvisational voices by putting them in a musical situation where they might not be 100% comfortable and seeing what happens. And my relationship to improvisation is to take individual voices and kind of create a setting and a narrative and something for them to respond to have a dialogue between that, the improvisation and the composed material.
But what you give them, the freedom, is for certain spots. I would call them for certain windows where they can express themselves. But the overall frame is a product by you, of your composition. So improvisation is a minor part in the music you do.
No, I definitely would not say it's a minor part. Like the music of Thelonious Monk, for instance, the soloing is a vehicle for expressing a larger picture. It's not just, you know, if you're playing a tune by Monk and it gets to the solo changes, if you just start playing the stuff you normally play, then you're not really doing it right, you know. And Monk was very insistent that the musicians that he worked with incorporate the music, the heads, into what he was, into the improvisation. And it all feels like, when you listen to a great Monk recording, it all feels like of a piece. And that's what I'm striving for.
Coming to the style of Darcy James Ardew, what is your music made up from? It's very easy to call it, in a very first and general sense, eclectic, or to call it omnivorous, that Mario Dunkel has called it. And in preparing this talk, I very much draw on this book here, on an article by Oldenburg musicologist Mario Dunkel, who has written a great paper on the music of Darcy James Ardew. Omnivorous, in German it is allesfressend. And to quote him, it would be easier to list active jazz artists who have not reached out to other arts recently than those who have. So this is, quote unquote, a sort of mainstream, that you don't only refer to jazz or jazz history, but if you draw explicitly to other sources like you do.
Yes, well, I've been involved in some multimedia productions, which I don't know if it's the new normal, but it is something that you are seeing people like Vijay Iyer and Jason Moran being involved in projects that are theatrical and contain a multimedia element in them and are not purely abstract music.
Then I have an interesting quote by you here. I'm exploring what big band music might sound like if it had stayed popular and incorporated all the music that's come along ever since. Rock, grunge, hip-hop, everything. Is your own words. Is it a description of what Dunkel calls omnivorous, or what I would call eclectic?
Sure. I mean, as a composer, you always want to reflect your own voice and your own personality and your own interests. And so that is what I would try to do. It would feel to me strange to exclude influences and to say, oh, well, I don't really want to touch that because, you know, jazz is jazz. And, you know, I may listen to these other types of music, but I don't want that affecting how I compose. You know, building a barrier like that feels very artificial to me.
That's something that has been done in the past in jazz history. You will always find jazz exploring music sources from the outside. This is not my position, but someone, let's say, from the classic could come to the conclusion, well, why do today's jazz composers have to draw from external sources? Isn't there enough in jazz history, quote-unquote, again, to be incorporated in the music? So what is somehow the legitimation to draw on external sources that have nothing to do with jazz?
Well, I'm not so sure that they have nothing to do with jazz. I mean, that's sort of the interesting thing, you know. As I said, it would feel artificial to limit my kind of musical inquiry. And one of the things that I look for when I'm incorporating doom metal or hip-hop or folk music or whatever it might be is, what are kind of the underlying commonalities? Like, what is this music doing? How does this music work kind of under the hood, you know, quite apart from the surface qualities of the music, which are easy to describe, of like, you know, just the sound of a doom metal guitar or whatever, but like, what is, you know, sort of really like, what is going on a deeper structural level, and what are the commonalities in the music that I love and my own musical influences, and is there a way that I can bring this into the world of big band, the world of secret society, that feels unforced and doesn't feel like it's easy to just take, a distorted guitar or to take a banjo or whatever it is and put something into the universe, or you'll hear like this early DX7 synthesizer tonight in Real Enemies. And, it's easy to take those things and just kind of graft them in. But what are the deeper connections? And, for instance, in this piece that uses the DX7 synth called Dark Alliance, the reference points there are like early 1980s West Coast LA hip-hop and electrofunk and Nicaraguan son. And those things are, I suppose, one might consider pretty distant from jazz. But then that electrofunk uses swing rhythms, uses swing sixteenths, and like a lot of the figures are very natural, and they come actually, I think, from big band originally. And so it was really fun to try to create something that merged those two universes and kind of something that at some point was influenced by jazz and morphed into something else and then kind of bring it back into the jazz fold.
Do you go to metal concerts?
I have, yes, yeah, with earplugs. But certainly in Brooklyn, there's lots of opportunity to hear all kinds of different music being made, and I do try to get out as much as I can and to see it live.
I have a proof for this because Rainer Michalke from the Stadtgarten says wherever he goes in a New York club, he sees Darcy James Arlio in the audience. Darcy, we are almost at the end of this talk, and I will just give you two quotes that came along last week to me. The first quote is from a German new music composer. In dem Moment, wo ich nicht mehr verstehe, was geschieht, entsteht Kunst. Enno Poppe is the guy. In the moment where I don't understand what's going on anymore, art arises. Right or wrong?
That's interesting. Certainly there is a trend of that, particularly in European music and in strains of American music that are very European influenced. What underlies something like that often can be a little bit of a suspicion of music that communicates. David Foster Wallace, the great American novelist, he has a really wonderful interview that he gave where he talks about sort of two opposing camps. There's sort of the avant-gardist camp where you're really only making art for other artists and other specialists, and it's entirely geared towards academia, and it's geared towards being deliberately obtuse and alienating and being sort of perceived as being smart in exactly the right ways. And it's this idea of, well, the audience are just idiots and I have contempt for them and I'm not making music for them. I'm making music only for other specialists in my community, sort of as embodied by the famous Milton Babbitt essay, "Who Cares If You Listen?" Right? And then on the other pole, you have people who are making just schlock and creating lowest common denominator entertainment that also has a real contempt for the audience, because it really is, they're all morons, and so I'm going to write as if they're morons, and I'm going to deliver them, just kind of served up on a platter, the most obvious manipulative stuff, and it's not coming from a place of creativity, it's coming from a place of, well, here's how I'm going to get paid. But both of these camps, what they have in common is just this contempt for the audience, and that's not something that I feel. I feel like as an artist, my whole goal is to communicate, and you don't have to understand everything it is that is going on, but I do feel like if there's nothing coming back from the audience, then I've failed. And that doesn't mean you can't challenge them. Like David Foster Wallace, certainly his books are very challenging to read, but they're also very rewarding, and they're fun. And he's sort of, even as he's engaging in some pretty avant-garde literary techniques, he's doing so in a way that is ultimately, at the end of the book, very rewarding for an audience member. And I think he is someone who really sort of managed to find the position in between those two poles, which is something that actually does have respect for the audience and is creating art in a way that invites the audience in, even if it's very challenging for them, that audiences, they enjoy being challenged. If you present it to them in a way where there are challenges for them, but there are rewards at the end. And so David Foster Wallace is really my lodestar for that.
With the last quote, we return to our camp. It goes like this: jazz is not a style, it's an attitude.
Sure. I mean, I think I would maybe say that jazz is, it's a tradition that comes out of a particular community. It's black music. It comes out of the experience of being black in America and all of what that entails. And it is the great gift of America's black community to the world, of creating this art that came from being shut out of other opportunities. There's so many amazing jazz musicians who were jazz musicians because they couldn't have a career as a classical piano soloist, or they couldn't play bass in the symphony orchestra because of discrimination. And so they made music of the highest quality that they could in response to that, and created this incredible tradition that combines all of the best aspects of music from many different cultures and many different traditions. And, you know, the wonderful thing about the omnivorous culture in America generally is that these things are possible. But then the black community has created jazz, and now it's out there, and it is played all over the world. And you have people from every country on the planet who, listen to recordings by Charlie Parker and Dizzy Gillespie and Thelonious Monk and are incredibly inspired and try to find their own way to be expressive within this incredible musical gift that has been bestowed on the planet. And I'm very, very grateful for that gift and for the generosity of those practitioners.
Sounds like a last word, and you opened a huge window now. I would have so many questions now, but a very tiny last question. From whom does the quote come from? Is it a musician or a critic? Jazz is not a style, it's an attitude. What is your guess?
Let's see. I'd say that probably that's a musician, but I'm not sure.
No, it's a critic.
Okay, well, there you
Thank
go.
Thank you so much, Darcy James Argue, up to this point. I have just one very final question that deals with this location here, Cologne. You are here for the third time, I think, with Cologne Contemporary Jazz Orchestra, who will perform your compositions tonight. What is the status of Cologne and the Stadtgarten to your work?
Well, it's always a pleasure to be back here. As I said, the premiere of Habeas Corpus was here in 2007. And I was fortunate, you know, Rainer Michalka has been a longtime supporter of my music and brought me here before I'd even recorded my first album with Secret Society, Infernal Machines. We recorded that in 2008, but at 2007 already, just on the strength of our live performances at the Bowery Poetry Club and elsewhere, he invited me to come and work with the group here before anyone had any idea who I was. And then I was back in 2010, had a performance here and then also at the North Sea Jazz Festival. And I was working on a piece for Bob Brookmeyer at that time called Blowout Prevention. So I have very vivid memories of sort of rehearsing during the day, and then in the afternoon I would go down to the basement, to the dressing room where there was a piano, and work on composing this piece. And then I would come up around dinner time, and the World Cup was on. And of course, you can imagine what Stadtgarten is like during the World Cup. So I would get my bratwurst and my kölsch and try and find a spot to sit and watch the game. And of course, when Germany lost, it was a very sad day in rehearsal the next day. Everyone came in, you know, their heads hung. But it was also, I feel like, a sort of a typical German reaction of everyone in the band was like, oh, we didn't deserve to win because Spain played better. It's like, well, I'm not sure you understand how sports fandom works in North America. We would never say that. But sure, all right. Yes, you are correct. Spain did play better.